but he learned from Francis that the doctor had ordered her a fortnight in bed. So Ross held back his letter of invitation, and instead sent her a longer one, explaining the circumstances, and inviting her to come and stay with them when she was better. Verity knew Demelza by sight, but had not seen her for the better part of 2 years, and Ross thought she would be unable to imagine what germ of senile decay had got into his brain. If this were so, she did not say as much in her letter of reply. "Dearest Ross, thank you for writing me so fully and explaining about your marriage. I am the last one able to criticize your attachment, but I should like to be the first to wish you the happiness I pray will be yours. When I am well and Papa is better, I will come and see you both. Love, Verity." The visit to Saul Church changed more than the name of the one-time kitchen maid. Judd and Prudy were inclined to take it badly at first, resenting, so far as they dared show it, the fact that the child who had come here as a waif and stray, infinitely beneath themselves, should now be able to call herself their mistress. They might have sulked for a long time if it had been anybody but Demelza. But in the end, she talked them, or hypnotized them, into the view that she was in part their protege, and so her advancement reflected a certain glory on them. And after all, as Prudy remarked privately to Judd, it was better than having to take orders from some fudgy-faced baggage with drop curls. Demelza did not see her father again that year. A few days after the banns were called, she persuaded Ross to send Judd to Illagan with a verbal message that they were to be married in a fortnight. Khan was down the mine when Judd arrived, so he was able only to deliver the message to a fat little woman in black. Thereafter silence fell. Demelza was nervous that her father might turn up and create a scene at the wedding, but all passed quietly. Tom Khan had accepted his defeat. On the 10th of July, a man called Jope Ishbel, one of the oldest and foxiest miners in the district, struck a load of red copper at Wheel Leisure. A great amount of water came with the discovery, and all work was held up while pumping gear was brought. The adit from the cliff face was making fair progress, but some time must pass before it could unwater the workings. All this water was looked on as a good sign by those who professed to know. When news of the find was brought to Ross, he opened an anchor of brandy and had big jugs of it carried up to the mine. There was great excitement, and from the mine they could see people climbing the ground behind Melling cottages a mile away and staring across to see what the noise was about. The find could not have been more opportune, for the second meeting of the venturers was due in a week's time, and Ross knew that he must ask for a further £50 from each of them. Jope Ishbel's strike armed him with tangible results, for even from the poor quality of the ore that Ishbel had brought to the surface, they could expect to get several pounds a ton more than from ordinary copper ore. The margin of profit was widened. If the load was a reasonably big one, it meant the certainty of a fair return. He did not fail to point this out when the meeting took place in Mr. Pierce's overheated offices in Truro, and the general effect was such that further drafts were voted without demur. This was the first time Ross had seen Mr. Treneglis since the great day at Mingus, when his son married Ruth Teague, and the old man went out of his way to be agreeable and complimentary. Over dinner, they sat together, and Ross was afraid that an apology was impending for the breach of manners between old neighbours in his not having been invited to the wedding. He knew the fault did not lie with Treneglis, and steered conversation away from the subject. Mr. Renfrew caused an awkward moment by getting above himself in his cups and following up a toast to the happy pair by proposing that they should not forget the bridegroom in their midst. There was a constrained silence, and then Mr. Pierce said,
"Yes, indeed. We must certainly not forget that."
And Dr. Choke said,
"That would be most remiss."
And Mr. Treneglis, who fortunately had caught the trend of the conversation, immediately got to his feet and said,
"My privilege, gentlemen, my pleasure and privilege. Our good friend, Dam, recently embarked upon matrimony himself. I give you the toast, Captain Poldark and his young bride. May they be very happy."
Everyone rose and drank.
"'Twould have looked bad if nobody'd mentioned it," said Mr. Treneglis,
not quite to himself as they sat down. Ross seemed the least embarrassed of them all. She had already grown into his life. That was what he thought. What he meant was that she had grown into the life of the house, seeing to his needs eagerly, but without fuss, a good servant and an agreeable companion. Under the new arrangement, this didn't much alter. Legally an equal, she remained in fact his inferior. She did what he said, no less eagerly, no less unquestioningly, and with a radiant goodwill to illuminate it all. If Ross had not wished to marry her, she would not have fretted for something else. But his decision to make the union legal and permanent, his honouring her with his name, was a sort of golden crown to set upon her happiness. Those few bad moments, when Elizabeth called, were almost forgotten and altogether discarded. And now she was growing into his life in a different way. There was no going back for him, even if he had wished it, which he found he did not. There was now no mistaking that he found her desirable. Events had proved it to be no delusion of a single summer night. But he was not yet at all sure how far it was she, personally, who was desirable to him, how far it was the natural needs of a man that she, as a woman, met. She did not seem to be troubled with any heart-searchings of her own. If she had grown and developed quickly before, now her personality flowered overnight. When a person is as happy as she was that summer, it is hard for others to be unaffected. And after a time the atmosphere she created began to have its effect on all in the house. The additional freedoms of marriage came to her slowly. Her first attempt in this direction was a mild suggestion to Ross that some day it would be a good thing to have the mine office moved from the library as the men walked across her flower beds in their big boots. No one was more surprised than she when a week later she saw a file of men carrying the mine papers up to one of the wooden sheds on the cliff. Even then, weeks passed before she could bring herself to steal into the library without the old sense of guilt. And it needed all the hardihood in the world to sit there trying to conjure tunes out of the derelict spinet when anyone was within hearing. But her vitality was so abundant that gradually it overcame the barriers which custom and subservience had set up. She began to strum more openly, and to sing low-voiced chants of her own devising. One day she rode in with Ross, and brought back a few broad sheets of verse, which she learned by heart, and then hummed to her own tunes on the spinet, trying to fit in sounds where they sounded right. As if to collaborate with Demelza's happiness, the summer was the warmest for years, with long weeks of bright quiet weather and rare full days of rain. After the epidemics of the winter, the fine clear weather was welcome to all, and the level at which many families spent the summer seemed like plenty compared with what had gone before. Work on Wheel Leisure was going slowly, but well. With the adit making progress towards the workings, every attempt was made to avoid the heavy cost of a pumping engine. Horse whims were devised one beside another, and the water thus raised was ingeniously dammed in a hollow and released down a teat to turn a water wheel, which itself worked a pump to raise more water. Copper was being mined now. Soon there would be enough to send a consignment into Truro for one of the ticketings. She had already grown into his life, he thought. Often now he wished he could separate the two Demelzas, who had become a part of him. There was a matter-of-fact, daytime Demelza, with whom he worked, and from whom, for a year or more, he had derived certain definite pleasures of companionship. this one he had grown to like and to trust. To be liked and trusted by her. Half-servant, half-sister. Comradely and obedient. The direct and calculable descendant of last year and the year before. Demelza learning to read. Demelza fetching wood for the fire. Demelza shopping with him and digging the garden and never still about her tasks. But the second was still a stranger. Although he was husband and master of them both, this one was incalculable, with the enigma of her pretty candle-lit face and fresh young body. All for his carnal satisfaction and increasing pleasure. In the first days he had held this one in a certain contempt. But events had moved beyond that. Contempt had gone, but the stranger was still left. Two not quite distinct persons. The stranger and the friend. It was unsettling in the day, in moments of routine and casual encounter, to get some sudden reminder of the young woman who could somehow call herself into being at will. Whom he took and owned, yet never truly possessed. Still more odd was it in the night to see sometimes peering from the drugged dark eyes of this stranger, the friendly untidy girl who had helped him with the horses or cut out his supper. At such times he was perturbed and not quite happy, as if he found himself trampling on something that was good in its own right. He wished he could separate these two. He felt he would be happier if he could separate them entirely. But as the weeks passed, it seemed that the reverse of what he wanted was taking place. The two entities were becoming less distinct. It was not until the first week of August that a fusion of the two occurred.
Chapter 2. Pilchards had come late to the coast that year. The delay had caused anxiety, for not only did the livelihood of many people depend on the arrival of the fish, but virtually in these times their existence. In the Scillies and the extreme south, the trade was already in full swing, and there were always wiseacres and pessimists who were ready to predict that the shoals would miss the northern shore of the county this year and go across to Ireland instead. A sigh of relief greeted the news that a catch had been made at St. Ives, but the first shoal was not sighted off Saul until the afternoon of the 6th of August. A hewer, watching from the cliff, as he had been watching for weeks, spotted the familiar dark red tinge far out to sea, and the cry he let out through his old tin trumpet inspirited the village. The seining boats instantly put out, seven men to each of the leading boats, four to the follower. Towards evening, it was known that both teams had made catches much above the average, and the news spread with great speed. Men working on the harvest at once downed tools and hurried to the village, followed by every free person from Grambler and many of the miners as they came off core. Judd had been into Grambler that afternoon and came back with the news to Demelza, who told Ross over their evening meal.
"I'm that glad," she said. "All Saul have been wearing faces down to their chins. 'Twill be a rare relief, and I hear it is a handsome catch."
Ross's eyes followed her as she rose from the table and went to trim the wicks of the candles before they were lighted. He had been at the mine all day and had enjoyed his supper in the shadowy parlour, with the evening stealing into and about the room. There was no real difference between now and that evening 2 months ago, when he had come home defeated and it had all begun. Jim Carter was still in prison. There was no real change in the futility of his own life and efforts. "Demelza," he said. "It is low tide at 11, he said, "and the moon's up. What if we rowed round to Saul and watched them putting down the tuck net?"
"Ross, that would be lovely."
"Shall we take Judd to help row us?" This to tease.
No. "Let us go. Just the two of us. Let us go alone, you and I, Ross."
She was almost dancing before his chair.
"I will row. I'm as strong as Judd any day. We'll go and watch, just the two of us alone.
He laughed. You'd think it was a ball I'd invited you to. Do you think I can't row you that far myself?
When shall we start?
In an hour.
Good, good, good. I'll make ready something to eat. And brandy in a flask, lest it be cold sitting, and a rug for me, and a basket for some fish.
She fairly ran from the room. They set off for Nampara Cove shortly after 9. It was a warm, still evening, with the 3/4 moon already high. In Nampara Cove, they dragged their small boat from the cave where it was kept, across the pale, firm sand to the sea's edge. Demelza got in, and Ross pushed the boat through the fringe of whispering surf and jumped in as it floated. The sea was very calm tonight, and the light craft was quite steady as he pulled towards the open sea. Demelza sat in the stern and watched Ross and looked about her and dipped a hand over the gunwale to feel the water trickling between her fingers. She was wearing a scarlet kerchief about her hair and a warm skin coat which had belonged to Ross as a boy and now just fitted her. They skirted the high, bleak cliffs between Nampara Cove and Saul Bay, and the jutting rocks stood in sharp silhouette against the moonlit sky. The water sucked and slithered about the base of the cliffs. They passed 2 inlets, which were inaccessible except by boat at any tide, being surrounded by steep cliffs. All this was as familiar to Ross as the shape of his own hand, but Demelza had never seen it. She had only once been out in a boat before. They passed the Queen Rock, where a number of good ships had come to grief, and then rounded a promontory into Saul Bay and came on the first fishers. They had let down the same net, a fine strong mesh of great length, with corks on the upper side and lead on the lower. Some distance past the promontory, and about 1/2 mile from the shore. With this great net, the seiners had enclosed about 2 acres of water and, they hoped, many fish. There was always the possibility, of course, that they had been wrongly directed by the man on the cliffs, who alone could see the movement of the shoal, or that some flaw on the seabed should have prevented the net from falling cleanly and so allowed the fish to slip away. But short of such accidents, there was every hope of a good catch.
And although in calm weather it might be possible to keep the net in position by means of grapnels for 10 days or a fortnight,
no one had the least intention of relying on good weather a minute longer than they had to. And tonight there was a moon. As low tide approached, the boat known as the Follower and carrying the tuck net was rowed cautiously into the enclosed area, marked by the bobbing corks supporting the great stop seine. The boat was rowed round within the area while the tuck net was lowered and secured at various points. This done, they began to haul in the tuck net again. It was at this crucial stage that Ross and Demelza came closely on the scene. They were not the only spectators. Every boat that would float and every human being that could sit in one had come out from Saul to watch. And those who had no craft or were too infirm stood on the shelving beach and shouted advice or encouragement. There were lights and lanterns in the cottages of Saul and all along the shingle bar and moving up and down on the blue-white waters of the cove. The moon lit up the scene with an unreal twilight. Seagulls flapped and screamed low overhead. No one took much notice of the new arrivals. One or two called friendly greetings. The arrival of Ross on the scene did not embarrass them as the arrival of others of the gentry might have done. He rowed his boat close to where the master seiner was standing in his craft, giving brief orders to the men who were within the circle hauling in the net. As it became clear that the net was heavy, a short silence fell. In a moment or two, it would be known whether the catch was a fine or a poor one, whether they had trapped a good part of the shoal or some part, with fish too small for salting and export, whether by some mischance they might have caught a shoal of sprats instead, as had happened a couple of years ago. On the result of the next few minutes, the prosperity of half the village hung. The only sound now was the bobble and swish of water against 50 keels and the deep,
"Yoy-ho! Hoy-ho!"
chorus of the men straining to haul in the net. Up and up came the net. The master seiner had forgotten his words of advice and stood there biting his fingers and watching the waters within the tuck net for the first sign of life. It was not long in coming. First, one of the spectators said something. Then another exclaimed. Then a murmur spread round the boats and increased to what was more a shout of relief than a cheer. The water was beginning to bubble. As if in a giant saucepan, it boiled and frothed and eddied, and then suddenly broke and disappeared and became fish. It was the miracle of Galilee enacted over again in the light of a Cornish moon. There was no water anymore, only fish, as big as herrings, jumbled together in their thousands, jumping, wriggling, glinting, fighting and twisting to escape. The net heaved and lurched. The big boats heeled over as the men strained to hold the catch. People talking and shouting, the splash of oars, the excited shouts of the fishers, the earlier noise was nothing to this. The tuck net was now fast, and the fishermen were already dipping baskets into the net and tipping them full of fish into the bottom of the boat. It seemed as if everyone was mindful of the haste necessary to take full advantage of good fortune. It was as if a storm waited just over the summit of the nearest cliff. Two big flat-bottom boats, like barges, were ferried alongside, and men hanging over the side began to work with fury to fill them. Other small boats quickly surrounded the net to take in the catch. Sometimes, the moonlight seemed to convert the fish into heaps of coins, and to Ross it looked like 60 or 80 dark-faced subhuman pygmies scooping at an inexhaustible bag of silver. Soon, men were up to their ankles in pilchards, soon up to their knees. Boats broke away and were rowed gingerly towards the shore, their gunwales no more than 2 inches above the lapping water. On shore, the activity was no less. Lanterns were everywhere while the fish were shoveled into wheelbarrows and hurried towards the salting cellars for picking over and inspection. Still, the work round the net went on, amongst the springing, gleaming fish. At the other side of the bay, another but lesser catch was being hauled in. Ross and Demelza ate their cakes and took a sip of brandy from the same flask and talked in lowered voices of what they saw.
"Home now?" Ross said presently. "A small bit longer," Demelza suggested. "The night is so warm. It is grand to be here."
He dipped his oars gently and straightened the bows of the boat towards the gentle lift and fall of the sea. They had drifted away from the crowds of boats, and it rather pleased him to get this detached view. He found, quite to his surprise, that he was happy. Not merely happy in Demelza's happiness, but in himself. He couldn't think why. The condition just existed within him. They waited and watched until the tuck net was almost cleared and the fishermen were going to lower it again. Then they waited to see if the second haul would be as big as the first. Whenever they were about to leave, some fresh interest held them. Time passed unnoticed while the moon on its downward path came near the coastline and picked out a silver stitching on the water. At last, Ross slowly exerted his strength on the oars, and the boat began to move. As they passed near the others, Pally Rogers recognized them and called,
"Good night!"
Some of the others paused, sweating from their labors, and also shouted.
"Good catch, eh, Pally?"
Ross said.
"Handsome! More than 250,000 fish, I reckon, before we're done."
"I'm very glad. It will make a difference next winter."
"Night, sir."
"Good night."
"Night, sir."
"Night."
They rowed away, and as they went, the sounds of all the voices and human activity slowly faded into a smaller space, into a little confined murmur in the great night. They rowed out towards the open sea and the sharp cliffs and the black dripping rocks.
"Everyone is happy tonight," Ross said, half to himself.
Demelza's face gleamed in the stern.
"They like you," she said, in an undertone. "Everyone do like you."
He grunted, "Little silly."
"No, 'tis the truth. I know because I'm one of them. You and your father was different from the others. But mostly you. You're...
She stumbled.
"You're half a gent, and half one of them. And then you trying to help Jim Carter and giving food to people."
"And marrying you." They passed into the shadow of the cliffs.
"No, not that," she said soberly. "Maybe they don't like that. But they like you all the same."
"You're too sleepy to talk sense," he said. "Cover your head and doze off till we're home." She did not obey, but sat watching the dark line where the shadow of the land ended and the glinting water began. She would have preferred to be out there. The shadow had lengthened greatly since they came out, and she would have rather made a wide circuit to keep within the friendly light of the moon. She stared into the deep darkness of one of the deserted coves they were passing. To these places no man ever came. They were desolate and cold. She could picture unholy things living there, spirits of the dead, things come out of the sea. She shivered and turned away. Ross said, "Take another nip of brandy."
"No."
She shook her head.
"No, not cold, Ross."
In a few minutes they were turning into Nampara Cove. The boat slipped through the ripples at the edge and grounded in the sand. He got out, and as she made to follow, caught her about the waist and carried her to dry land. He kissed her before he put her down. When the boat was drawn up into its cave and the oars hidden where a casual vagrant could not find them, he rejoined her, where she was waiting just above the high water mark. For a while, neither of them made a move, and they watched the moon set. As it neared the water, it began to grow misshapen and discoloured, like an overripe blood orange squeezed between sea and sky. The silver sword across the sea became tarnished and shrank until it was gone, and only the old moon remained, bloated and dark, sinking into the mists. Then, without words, they turned, walked across the sand and shingle, crossed the stream at the stepping stones, and walked together hand in hand the half mile to the house. She was quite silent. He had never done what he had done tonight. He had never kissed her before, except in passion. This was something different. She knew him to be closer to her tonight than he had ever been before. For the very first time, they were on a level. It was not Ross Poldark, gentleman farmer of Nampara, and his maid, whom he had married because it was better than being alone. They were a man and a woman, with no inequality between them. She was older than her years, and he younger. And they walked home, hand in hand, through the slanting shadows of the new darkness. "I am happy," he thought again. "Something is happening to me, to us, transmuting our shabby little love affair. Keep this mood. Hold on to it. No slipping back." The only sound all the way home was the bubbling of the stream beside their path. The house greeted them whitely. Moths fluttered away to the stars and the trees stood silent and black. The front door creaked as they closed it, and they climbed the stairs with the air of conspirators. When they reached their room, they were laughing breathlessly at the thought of waking Judd and Prudy with such gentle noises. She lit the candles and closed the windows to keep the moths out, took off the heavy coat and shook out her hair. Oh yes, she was lovely tonight. He put his arms about her, his face still boyish in its laughter, and she laughed back at him, her mouth and teeth gleaming moist in the candlelight. At this, his smile faded, and he kissed her.
"Ross," she said. "Dear Ross."
"I love you," he said, "and am your servant. Demelza, look at me. If I've done wrong in the past, give me leave to make amends." So he found that what he had half despised was not despicable, that what had been for him the satisfaction of an appetite, a pleasant but commonplace adventure in disappointment, owned wayward and elusive depths he had not known before, and carried the knowledge of beauty in its heart. Chapter 3. September of that year was clouded by the death of Charles. The old man had grunted miserably on all through the summer, and the doctor had given him up a half dozen times. Then one day, perversely, he collapsed just after Choke had made his most favourable report of the year, and died before he could be resummoned. Ross went to the funeral, but neither Elizabeth nor Verity was there, both being ill. The funeral attracted a big attendance, both of village and mining people, and of the local gentry, for Charles had been looked on as the senior personage of the district, and had been generally liked within the limits of his acquaintance. Cousin William Alfred took the service, and, himself affected by the bereavement, preached a sermon which was widely agreed to be of outstanding quality. Its theme was, "A Man of God." What did the phrase mean, he asked. It meant to nourish those attributes in which Christ himself had been so conspicuous: truth and honesty, purity of heart, humility, grace and love. How many of us had such qualities? Could we look into our own hearts and see there the qualities necessary to make us men and women of God? A time such as this, when we mourned the passing of a great and good man, was a time for self-inspection and a renewed dedication. It was true to say that in the loss of our dear friend Charles Poldark, we marked the passing of a man of God. His way had been upright. He had never spoken an ill word. From him you grew to expect only kindness and the courtesy of the true gentleman, who knew no evil and looked for none in others. The steady, unselfish leadership of a man whose existence was an example to all. After William Alfred had been talking in this vein for 5 minutes, Ross heard a sniff in the pew beside him, and saw Mrs. Henshaw dabbing unashamedly at her nose. Captain Henshaw, too, was blinking his blue eyes, and several others were weeping quietly. Yes, it was a beautiful sermon, tugging at the emotions and conjuring up pictures of greatness and peace. But were they talking about the decent, peppery, ordinary old man he knew? Or had the subject strayed to the story of some saint of the past? Or were there two men being buried under the same name? One perhaps had shown himself to such as Ross, while the other had been reserved for the view of men of deep insight, like William Alfred. Ross tried to remember Charles before he was ill. Charles, with his love of cockfighting and his hearty appetite, with his perpetual flatulence and passion for gin, with his occasional generosities and meannesses and faults and virtues like most men. There was some mistake somewhere. Oh well, this was a special occasion. But Charles himself would surely have been amused. Or would he have shed a tear with the rest for the manner of man who had passed away? William Alfred was drawing to the end. "My friends, we may fall far short of the example which is thus set before us. But in my Father's house are many mansions, and there shall be room for all that believe. Equality of life, equality of opportunity are not for this world. Blessed are the humble and the meek, for they shall see God.
and he in his infinite wisdom shall weigh us all. Blessed are the poor, for they shall enter into heaven because of their poverty. Blessed are the rich, for they shall enter into heaven because of their charity. So in the hereafter there shall be one mighty concourse of people, all provided for after their several needs, all rewarded according to their virtues, and all united in the one sublime privilege of praising and glorifying God. Amen.
There was a scraping of vials as the three musicians by the chancel steps prepared to strike up. The choir cleared their throats, and his son wakened Mr. Treneglis. Ross accepted the invitation to return to Trenwith, hoping he might see Verity, but neither she nor Elizabeth came down. He did not stay longer than to drink a couple of glasses of canary, and then he made his excuses to Francis and walked home. He was sorry he had not come straight back. The attitude of some of the mourners had a certain pained withdrawnness towards himself. Despite his own thoughts at the time of his marriage, he was unprepared for it, and he could have laughed at himself and at them. Ruth Treneglis, nay Teague, Mrs. Teague, Mrs. Chenoweth, Polly Choke, quacking geese with their trumpery social distinctions and their sham code of ethics. Even William Alfred and his wife had been a little constrained. No doubt to them, his marriage looked too much like the mere admission of the truth of an old scandal. Of course, William Alfred, in his well-intentioned way, took the family very seriously. Joshua had rightly called him its conscience. He liked to be consulted, no doubt. Old Mr. Warleggan had been very distant, but that was more understandable. The episode of the courtroom rankled. So perhaps did Ross's refusal to put the mine business through their hands. George Warleggan was far too careful in his manners to show what he felt. Well, well. The whole of their disapproval added together didn't matter an eye-wink. Let them stew. As he reached his own land, Ross's annoyance began to leave him at the prospect of seeing Demelza again. In fact, he was disappointed, for when he reached home, Demelza had gone to Melling Cottages, taking some extra food for Ginny and a little coat she had made for her week-old baby. Benjamin Ross, too, had been having trouble with his teeth, and last month had had a convulsion. Ross had seen his 2.5-year-old namesake recently, and had been struck by the coincidence that Reuben's knife had left a scar on the child's face, roughly similar to his own. He wondered if this would be remarked when the boy grew up. He decided to walk over to Melin now, in the hope of meeting Demelza on the way back. He met his wife 200 yards from the cottages. As always, it was a peculiar pleasure to see her face light up, and she came running and hopping to meet him.
"Ross, how nice. I didn't expect he back yet."
"It was indifferent entertainment," he said, linking her arm. "I'm sure Charles would have been bored."
"Shh."
She shook her head at him in reproof.
"'Tis poor luck to joke about such things. Who was there? Tell me who was there."
He told her, pretending to be impatient, but really enjoying her interest. "That's all. It was a sober crew. My wife should have been there to brighten it up."
Was Elizabeth not there?"
she asked. "No, nor Verity. They are both unwell. The bereavement, I expect. Francis was left to do the honours alone." "And your invalids?"
"My invalids?"
"Ginny and the infant."
"Oh, they are well. A proper little girl. Ginny is well, but very much down. She is listless-like and lacks poor Jim."
"And little Benji Ross and his teeth? What's the matter with the boy? Do they grow out of his ears?"
"He is much better, my love. I took some oil of valerian and told Ginny... What is the word?"
"Instructed?"
"No."
"Prescribed?"
"Yes. I prescribed it for him, like an apothecary. So many drops, so many times a day. And Ginny opened her blue eyes and said, "Yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am," just as if I was a real lady.
"So you are," said Ross. She squeezed his arm.
"So I am. I'd forget, Ross. Anybody you loved, you would make a lady."
"Nonsense," said Ross. "The blame's entirely yours. Have they heard of Jim this month?"
"Not this month. You heard what they heard last month."
"That he was well, yes. For my part, I doubt it. But fine and good if it reassures them."
"Do we think you could ask someone to go and see him?"
"I've already done so, but no report yet. It is true that Bodmin is the best of a bad lot, for what consolation that may be."
"Ross, I've been thinking."
"What?"
"You told me I'd ought to have someone else in to help in the house. To give me more time, like. Well, I thought to ask Ginny Carter."
"What? And have three infants crawling about the house?"
"No, no. Mrs. Zaki could look after Benji and Mary. They could play with her own. Ginny could bring her mite and sit her in a box in the sun all day. She'd be no trouble."
"What does Ginny say?"
"I haven't asked her. I thought to see what you said first."
"Settle it between yourselves, my dear. I have no objection." They reached the top of the hill by Wheel Grace, and Demelza broke away from him to pick some blackberries. She put two in her mouth and offered him the choice of a handful. He took one absently. "I too have been thinking. A good flavour this year. I too have been thinking. Now that Charles is gone, Verity is much in need of a rest. It would give me much pleasure to have her here for a week or two, to recuperate from all her nursing." They went down the hill. He waited for her to speak, but she did not. He glanced down at her. The vivacity had gone from her face, and some of the colour. "Well?"
"She wouldn't come."
"Why do you say that?"
"All your family. They hate me."
"None of my family hate you."
"They don't know you. They may disapprove, but Verity is different." "How can she be if she's one of the family?"
"Well, she is. You don't know her." There was silence for the rest of the walk home. At the door they parted. But he knew that the discussion was not finished. He knew Demelza well enough now to be sure that nothing but a clear-cut issue was ever satisfactory to her. Sure enough, when he went out to go to the mine, she ran after him.
"Ross?"
He stopped.
"Well?"
She said,
"They think... your family think you was mad to marry me. Don't spoil this first summer by asking one of them to stay here. You told me just now I was a lady. But I ain't. Not yet. I can't talk proper, and I can't eat proper, and I'm always getting cagged with dirt. And when I'm vexed, I swear. Maybe I'll learn. If you'll learn me, I'll learn. I'll try all the time. Next year, maybe."
"Verity isn't like that," Ross said. "She sees deeper than that. She and I are much alike."
"Oh, yes," said Demelza, nearly crying. "But she's a woman. You think I'm nice because you're a man. Tedn't that I'm suspicious of her. But she'll see all my faults and tell you about them, and then you'll never think the same again."
"Walk with me up here," Ross said quietly. She looked up into his eyes, trying to read his expression. After a moment she began to walk beside him, and they climbed the field. At the gate he stopped and leaned his arms on it. "Before I found you," he said, "when I came home from America, things looked black for me. You know why? Because I'd hoped to marry Elizabeth and return to find her with other plans. That winter it was Verity alone who had saved me. Well, I was a fool to take it so to heart. Nothing is really worth that. But I couldn't fight it at the time, and Verity came and kept me going 3 and 4 times a week. All through the winter she came. I can't ever forget that.
She gave me something to hold on to. That's hard to repay. For 3 years now, I've neglected her shamefully. Perhaps when she most needed me. She has preferred to stay indoors, not to be seen about. I have not had the same need of her. Charles was ill, and she thought it her first duty to nurse him. But it can't go on. Now Charles is dead. Francis tells me she's really ill. She must get away from that house for a change. The least I can do is to ask her here. Demelza moodily rustled the dry stubble of barley stalks under her foot.
But why has she need of you? If she is ill, she needs a surgeon, that's all. She'll be the better looked after at Trenwith.
Do you remember when you first came here? A man used to call. Captain Blamey. She looked at him with eyes in which the pupils had grown dark.
No.
Verity and he were in love with each other. But Charles and Francis found that he had been married before. There were the strongest objections to his marrying Verity. Communication between him and Verity was forbidden, and so they used to meet here, secretly. Then one day Charles and Francis found them here, and there was a violent quarrel, and Captain Blamey went home to Falmouth, and Verity has not seen him since.
Oh, said Demelza moodily.
Her sickness, you see, is one of the spirit. She may be ill other ways too, but can I deny her the help that she gave me? To find a change of company, to get away from brooding, that may be half the battle. You could help her so much if you tried.
I could.
You could. She has so little interest in life, and you're so full of it. You have all the zest for living, and she none. We have to help her together, my dear. And for this, I want your willing help, with no grudging. On the gate she put her hand over his.
Sometimes, she said, I feel angry-like, and then I go all small and mean. But of course I'll do it, Ross. Anything you say.
Chapter 4 Demelza nightly prayed that Verity would not come. When a reply was brought, and she learned that her cousin-in-law had accepted the invitation and hoped to be well enough by next weekend, her heart turned over and climbed into her throat. She tried to hide her panic from Ross and to accept his amused assurances. During the rest of the week, her fears found outlet in a frenzy of summer cleaning, so that not a room was left unscoured, and Prudy moaned wild complaints each morning at the sight of her. No amount of work could stave off Saturday's approach, and with it Verity's. She could only hope that Aunt Agatha would have a fit, or that she herself would go down with measles just in time. Verity came shortly after midday, attended by Bartle, carrying two valises, strapped behind him. Ross, who had not seen his cousin for some months, was shocked at the change. Her cheeks had sunk, and the healthy open-air tan was gone. She looked 40 instead of 29. The gleam of vitality and keen intelligence had gone out of her eyes. Only her voice was the same, and her disobedient hair. Demelza's knees, which had wanted to give way earlier in the morning, were now as stiff and immovable as her lips. She stood at the door in her plain pink frock, trying not to look like a ramrod, while Ross helped his cousin from her horse and kissed her.
"Ross, how good to see you again. It's so kind of you to have me. And how well you look. The life is agreeing with you."
She turned and smiled at Demelza.
"I do wish I could have been at your wedding, my dear. It was one of my biggest disappointments."
Demelza let her cold cheek be kissed, and stood aside to watch Verity and Ross enter the house. After a few moments, she followed them into the parlour. "This isn't my room now," she thought. "Not mine and Ross's. Someone else has taken it away from us. In the middle of our bright summer." Verity was slipping off her cloak.
Demelza was interested to notice that she was very plainly dressed underneath. She wasn't beautiful like Elizabeth, but quite elderly and plain. And her mouth was like Ross's, and sometimes the tone of her voice.
At the end, Verity was saying, I don't think Father minded so much. He was so very tired.
She sighed.
Had he not gone so suddenly, we would have summoned you. Oh well, that's over. Now I feel only like rest.
She smiled slightly.
I am afraid I shall not be a sportive guest, but the last thing I want is to put you or Demelza to any trouble. Do just as you have always done, and leave me to fit in. That is what I want best.
Demelza racked her brains for the sentences she had prepared this morning. She twisted her fingers and got out.
You would like something to drink now, after your ride? I have been recommended to take milk in the morning and porter at night, and I hate them both. But I had my milk before I left, so thank you, no, I'll stay dry.
It's not like you to be ill, Ross said. What ails you but fatigue? What does Choke say?
1 month he bleeds me, and the next he tells me I am suffering from anemia. Then he gives me potions that make me sick, and vomits that don't. I doubt if he knows as much as the old women at the fair. I knew an old woman once.
Demelza began impulsively, and then stopped. They both waited for her to go on.
It don't matter, she said. I'll go and see if your room's ready.
She wondered if the lameness of the excuse was as plain to them as it was to her. But at least they raised no objection. So she gratefully escaped and went across to Joshua's old bedroom, which was to be Verity's. There she pulled back the coverlet and turned and stared at the two valises as if to stare through them into their contents. She wondered how she would ever get through the next week. All that evening and all the following day, constraint was heavy on them, like an autumn fog hiding familiar landmarks. Demelza was the culprit, but she couldn't help herself. She had become the intruder. Two were company, and three none. Ross and Verity had a good deal to say to each other, and he stayed in more than he would have done. Whenever Demelza entered the living room, their talk always broke. It was not that they had any secrets from her, but that the topic was outside her sphere, and to continue it would be to ignore her. It was always hard at meals to find a subject which would include Demelza. There was so much that would not. The doings of Elizabeth and Francis, the progress of Geoffrey Charles, news of common friends Demelza had never heard of. Ruth Treneglis was blossoming forth as the Chatelaine of Mingus. Mrs. Chenoweth, Elizabeth's mother, was troubled with her eyes, and the doctors advised an operation. Cousin William Alfred's second youngest had died of measles. Henry Fielding's new book was all the rage. These and many other items were pleasant to chat over with Ross, but meant nothing to Ross's wife. Verity, who was as susceptible as anyone, would have made her excuses and left on the third day if she had been sure that Demelza's stiffness was the outcome of dislike or jealousy. But Verity thought it arose from something else, and she hated the idea of leaving now, with the knowledge that she could never return. She disliked equally the thought that she was coming between Ross and his young wife. But if she went now, her name would be forever linked with this visit, and she would never be mentioned between them. She was sorry she had come. So she stayed on, and hoped for an improvement without knowing how to bring it about. Her first move was to stay in bed in the mornings, and not get up until she was sure Ross was out of the house. Then she would come on Demelza accidentally, and talk to her, or help her in the work she was doing. If this could be settled at all, then it must be settled between them while Ross was out of the way. She hoped that she and the other girl would lapse into companionship with nothing said. But after a couple of mornings, she found her own casual manner becoming too noticeably deliberate. Demelza tried to be kind, but she thought and spoke from behind a shield. Advances upon that sense of inferiority could easily be mistaken for patronage. On the Thursday morning, Demelza had been out since dawn. Verity broke her fast in bed and rose at 11. The day was fine but overcast, and a small fire burned in the parlour, attracting the usual patronage of Tabitha Bethia. Verity perched on the settle and shivered, and began to stir the logs to make them blaze. She felt old and tired, and the mirror in her room showed a faint yellow tinge to her skin. It wasn't really that she cared whether she looked old or not these days, but she was always so listless, so full of aches, could do no more than half the work of a year ago. She slid farther into the corner of the settle. The pleasantest thing of all was to sit back as she was doing now, head against the velvet cover, to feel the warmth in her feet from the fire, to have nothing at all to do, and no one to think of. Having slept all night, and been awake no more than 3 hours, she went off to sleep again. One slippered toe stretched towards the fire, one hand hanging over the wooden arm of the settle, Tabitha curled against her foot, purring lightly. Demelza came in with an armful of beech leaves and wild rose hips. Verity sat up.
"Oh, beg pardon,"
Demelza said, ready to go.
"Come in," Verity said in confusion. "I've no business to be sleeping at this hour. Please talk to me and help me wake."
Demelza smiled reservedly, put the armful of flowers on a chair.
"Do you feel the draught from this window? You should have shutten." "No, no, please. I don't consider the sea air harmful. Let it be."
Demelza closed the window and pushed a hand through her ruffled hair.
"Ross'd never forgive me if you caught cold. These Mallows is dead. Their heads are all drooping. I'll bury them."
She picked up the jug and carried it from the room, returning with it freshly filled with water. She began to arrange the beech leaves. Verity watched her.
"You were always fond of flowers, weren't you? I remember Ross telling me that once."
Demelza looked up.
"When did he tell you that?"
Verity smiled.
"Years ago. Soon after you first came. I admired the flowers in here, and he told me you brought them in fresh every day."
Demelza flushed slightly.
"All the same, you got to be careful,"
she said, in a matter-of-fact voice.
"Tedn't every flower takes kindly to being put in a room. Some of them looks pretty, but they fair stink when you pick 'em."
She thrust in a spray or two of the rose hips. The beech leaves were just turning a delicate yellow, and they toned with the yellow-orange-red of the hips.
"I've been trespassing today, picking these. Over as far as Bodruggenland."
She stood back to look at the effect.
"And sometimes flowers don't take kindly to one another, and no matter how you try to coax them, they won't share the same jug."
Verity stirred in her seat. She must take the risk of a frontal attack.
"I ought to thank you, my dear, for what you've done for Ross."
The other girl's body tautened a little, like a wire on the first hint of strain.
"What he's done for me, more like."
"Yes, perhaps you're right," Verity agreed, some of the old spirit creeping into her voice.
"I know he's brought you up, all that, but you seem to have made him fall in love with you, and that has changed his whole life."
Their eyes met. Demelza's were defensive and hostile, but also puzzled. She thought there was antagonism behind the words, but couldn't make out where it lay.
"I don't know what you mean."
This was the final issue between them.
"You must know," Verity said, "that when he came home, he was in love with Elizabeth, my sister-in-law." "I know that. You haven't any need to tell me that. I know it as well as you."
Demelza turned to leave the room. Verity got up. For this she had to stand.
"Perhaps I've expressed myself badly since I came here,"